Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June the 24th, and we are towards the end of Parshas Bo. We're on page 360, and we're towards the bottom. We're beginning chapter 13, Yud Gimel. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lema, Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Kadesh li chol b'char, sanctify for me all firstborns, Peter kol rechem, the one that has exited the womb first. How do they translate it here? The
first
issue.
Of every womb.
Okay, of every womb. Bifnei, so amongst the children of Israel, ba'adam u'vavahema, people and animals, li hu, they belong to me. So this commandment, and this set of commandments and laws are going to go from here to the end of Bo for the next couple of paragraphs. And they are being said to Moshe, whether they were said to Moshe prior to them leaving Egypt or right after they left Egypt, but they clearly are a connection, or they're connected to the last plague, the plague of the death of the firstborn. And as a result of Hashem killing the firstborn Egyptians and keeping our firstborn alive, there is a sanctity that is accorded to the firstborn. And as you see, it applies to both people and animals. Now, there are some details which we're going to get into which are technical to understand exactly the parameters of the law. But then there's also the depths of understanding of how this law is set up. We've talked about Bechor, about firstborn, the concept of the birthright and firstborn many times. We started talking about it back, really, even before Yaakov and Esav, where it really comes to the forefront. But we even spoke about it well before that with Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, and we spoke about it even with Noach's sons. We've discussed this many times over, and especially here with death of the firstborn, we talked about it at length. For tonight, it's worthwhile restating one main point, which is that for us today, the position of firstborn is not that significant. Now, I am a secondborn. My brother, who is a firstborn, always likes to say it's extremely significant. But for us, it's not that significant a thing. In the event that a woman's firstborn child is a boy, and the birth is natural, it's not a C-section, and there are no miscarriages preceding the birth of that son, and neither the father nor the mother is a Kohen or a Levi, if all of those factors fall into place, then that son will fall into the category we're going to discuss over here, and they will have to perform a pidyon haben. They will have to redeem the firstborn. That mitzvah happens. It's not extremely rare, but most people don't do it. So, for example, my brother is a Bechor, he's a firstborn. All the criteria are there, except that my mother is a Levi. So my parents did not perform a pidyon haben on my brother. But in my case, my son is a firstborn, and all the criteria are there, and we did perform a pidyon haben. So it just depends on how, if everything's going to work out, that all the pieces fall into place. But other than that, there's not much that is significant about being a firstborn, except for one thing that also comes up, and who knows what that is?
Double portion.
That a firstborn son, in the laws of inheritance, if there is nothing done before death in order to change the way things will happen, if it's just going to follow the natural order the Torah sets up, then the firstborn son will get a double portion. Which means that, let's say there are four inheritors, the firstborn son, you'll divide the inheritance five ways instead of four ways, and the firstborn son will get two of the five, and the other three will get one of the five. That would be the way the Torah sets it up. We will get to those laws in a little while. That's in Parshas Pinchas. So it'll be a little while before we get there. what's an interesting point is that the birthright for inheritance follows the father, meaning that it has to be the firstborn of the father, the first child that the father has. Whereas the laws we're studying now, when it comes to redeeming the firstborn, then it's the, as we said here, the first issue of every womb. It follows the mother. The firstborn child of the mother is the one that will need to be redeemed in regard to the firstborn over here. So that's a curiosity which is worthwhile thinking about, why there should be that difference. And the truth is that tonight we're not going to focus so much on the inheritance part, because we're not up to there yet. When we get to there, we'll examine that further. Tonight, we should focus primarily on this, why this particular mitzvah applies to the firstborn from the mother rather than from the father. The main thing is from the mother, which means that if a man ends up over his lifetime marrying more than one woman, if he marries a woman and there's a death or divorce and marries another woman or something like that, he could have to redeem two firstborn sons. It's possible. Mm-hmm. Right. So, depends on, if everything falls into place. So, that's something which is worthwhile thinking about. The firstborn, the Bechor, as we know, were meant to perform the service in the temple. They were supposed to be the Kohanim. We know that eventually they're going to lose that position because of the sin of the golden calf, and they will be replaced by the Kohanim, the real Kohanim. But the Bechor, the firstborn, were supposed to be the ones to do the service in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Bechor would have been a much more significant position had the sin of the golden calf not occurred. Which means that today, where, for instance, to get an aliyah at the Torah, we know we call the Kohen first, then we call the Levi, and then everybody else. But Kohen and Levi, Kohen is first, Levi is second, then everybody else. Had they not sinned at the golden calf, then there would have been no such thing as Kohen and Levi, and it's possible, I don't know for certain, but it's possible the first aliyah would have gone to firstborns. They would have been first, because they're the ones who perform the service in the Beis HaMikdash. Now that's also a fascinating thing to think about, because it's one thing to acknowledge a certain family or a certain line, in this case, the children of Aaron, children of Aaron. We know that their descendants are the Kohanim. So we recognize that we have this line amongst the Jewish people, and they are Kohanim. I am not a Kohen, perhaps one of you is a descendant of a Kohen. So we recognize them as the Kohanim. These days, it's rare that anybody has intense jealousy of the Kohanim because there's no temple. So what does it get them? It gets them the first aliyah in the shul. And also, they're the ones who bless us when they stand in front and they duchen. Okay, it's not something to be, to make a big deal out of. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, I think there would be more, if not jealousy, envy or something. You know, people would say, it's really nice they get to serve in the temple, and we don't. So that's something that's pretty special. But there, it's a class of family, a particular family that we can very easily understand it, that, well, their great ancestor, Aaron, had a particular piety that he succeeded in reaching a certain level, and he was able to pass that on to his descendants, and they have a certain level of spiritual greatness to live up to. Now, we can understand that, and we understand that every family has its own strengths, every tribe has its own strengths, and that's the strength of the tribe of Levi, specifically the Kohen family. I think we can accept that and deal with that, and even in the time of the temple, where there really is what to be envious of, one has a way of saying, okay, that's their family's special traits. If I come from the tribe of, whatever it is, Asher has his special traits, and Naphtali has his special traits, and Yehuda has his special traits, we can all deal with that. It's fascinating that had the system not changed because of the sin of the golden calf, then what would have happened is within each family, there would have been a very clear difference between the children. The firstborn gets to serve in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, and the other children do not. My brother would serve and I would not. That's a little bit harder to understand and to deal with, because just because he was born first, he gets to serve. Why is he, I don't want to use the word better, but I want to say it's harder. What I mean to say is, I can understand that your family has your abilities and your troubles, and my family has my abilities, our abilities, and our troubles. Everybody is different. It's a little bit easier to understand it that way. But my brother, just because he was born first, gets to serve, that gives him some sort of leg up. What happened? What does that mean? So that's something to think about. What is this special quality that comes from what? From being the firstborn from the mother. The first issue of the womb. That's very, very important to think about. Why does that... Clearly it's nothing that my brother did. He was born into it. So what is it? It's not genes. I have the same genes he does. I mean, it's not the blood of the family line. We're the same family line. The exact same family line. What gives him that special quality just because he was the first one out and I was only the second? I'm not bitter or anything, right?
Maybe the firstborn son is more responsible for the family. Maybe that's also why he gets a double portion, because he has to spend more them.
So that's a nice way of thinking about it. But as we pointed out, it follows a different line. You could have two half brothers, where one is getting a double portion but not serving in the temple, and the other one serving in the temple but not getting the double portion, because one's the firstborn from the father and one's the firstborn from the mother. So it doesn't those two things don't necessarily line up. They can line up, but they don't have to.
Okay.
The firstborn are like the first fruits, and they belong to Hashem.
Okay, that's well said. Now, where do we have a precedent for that? You didn't think I was going to put you on the spot. You're right. We've talked about this before. When is the word Bechor, firstborn, when is it used for the first time in the Torah?
The Bechorim that brought the Beis HaMikdash?
What's that?
The Bechorim that brought the first of the fruit that's brought set aside. For
Before that?
With Cain and Hevel?
With Cain and Hevel, where?
So he brought the first
offering. With the first sacrifices, the first, they weren't really sacrifices, there was nothing slaughtered. The first offerings that were brought to Hashem by Cain and Hevel, which caused the first murder.
Right.
When one was answered and one wasn't. So Cain, who brought the first offering, and his was not accepted by Hashem, because his was not the best. He brought an offering, which was a nice idea, but it was not his best. He just brought the flax of the ground. Whereas Hevel brought, it says, mi bechoro sono, from the firstborn of his sheep, of his flock. He brought the first. Now, does the first mean that it's the best? It may have been the best, but it doesn't have to be the best. It could be that in terms of, let's take sheep, cattle, actually there was something slaughtered, the animal was slaughtered. So it was a sacrifice. Those animals, in terms of a sacrifice, the best animal is going to be the largest, most beautiful animal is going to be the most significant sacrifice. And he brought the firstborn. So what was so good about the firstborn that he offered it to Hashem, and it was accepted by Hashem?
You
sanctify. When something's the first, you kind of want to keep it.
Why? Why do you want to keep it if it's the first?
You're proud of it.
The first.
Beloved.
New.
It's new.
There wasn't something like that.
It's yours. But what's bothering me is is really the girl. You know, why the firstborn has to be the male.
Why a male, not a female? Okay, that's a different
question. A female not serving in the temple and all, but
something?
No, that's a good question. That's a good question. That's a different question than what that we're asking. But that's a good question as well. We'll have to tackle that also.
If it's new and it's the first thing, it's kind of hard to give it up.
Okay. So you're asking a good question, which is why only the males and not the females, which is a very good question. Here it doesn't say that. Later in the Torah is where it says only the males, not the females. But that's a very good point. We should talk about that as well. You don't want to give up the first thing because it's special. We mentioned a few weeks back, there's something else about a first. Go ahead.
We had mentioned
that
it was a miracle. It's a partnership between Hashem and men.
Right. That's true. But all children are a partnership between Hashem and the parents.
But it's the first time. The first.
Yeah, right. You're right. Let's say more sharply. Go ahead.
I think we get back to what you said earlier, which is that it is the first which makes the parents parents.
Okay.
It's the realization of potential. With the first, you go from potential life-giving to actual life-giving.
Okay. So with the first, you become a parent. Without the second does not make the parents into parents. The parents love their children. They love all their children. But the first one makes the parents into parents. It transforms the parent from not being a parent to being a parent. So that first is a transformative figure. Why the mother, not the father? So here, the simple answer is, and we'll leave it with the simple answer for the time being, is that with this particular mitzvah, you can easily ascertain the firstborn of the mother. Mm-hmm. That's simple. That everybody sees it. A pregnancy is seen by all. You can't miss a pregnancy almost always, right? It's not something which the way Hashem set up the world is that it's something everybody can see, and therefore, everybody knows, and also it's very hard to hide a little baby. I mean, when a child is born, it's a well-known thing. And a child is born, as the Gemara says, with cries. So it's loud. It's everybody knows about it. It was never meant to be something that no one's going to know about. So you know when a mother becomes a mother for the first time. Everybody knows when a mother becomes a mother for the first time. You can't miss it. When does a father become a father for the first time? When his wife has a baby. You don't necessarily know who the father is. Even if you know, but it's not necessarily. It doesn't have to be that way. The father can be on one side of the world and the mother on the other side of the world, and the father becomes a father. He's not even there, and nobody is there to associate the father with the child. So it's not such a clear correlation. Whereas a mother clearly becomes a mother for the first time when she has her first baby. So that transformation of going from not being a mother to being a mother is clear and obvious to all. So therefore, and as I said, this is the simple level, therefore the mitzvah of the firstborn, and this is both for people and for animals, is going to follow the mother. When the mother has a child for the first time, that firstborn, and right now we're dealing with males, which is Doreen's question, why males? But that firstborn male child, that male child is going to be, what's that?
How to record that part, huh?
It's going to be forever. Forever. It's recorded. Your great, great, great grandchildren are going to hear this. That firstborn child has to be redeemed. Okay. So let's read a little further and we'll get back to your question. So Hashem says, sanctify the first ones, both in people and animals, they are mine. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Moshe said to the people, Zochor es hayom hazeh, remember this day, Asher yitzasem mimitzrayim, that you went out of Egypt, mibeis avodim, from a house of slavery, ki bechozek yad, for with a strong hand, Hosi Hashem etchem mizeh, Hashem has taken you out from this. For lo ye achel chametz, and chametz shall not be eaten. Leavened bread shall not be eaten. So this word zachor et hayom hazeh, remember this day. That is one of the things that we need to remember every day. There are some things in the Torah that we are told to remember all the time. For instance, recently we had in the Chumash, Zachar Esa Asher Asa Hashem Elokecha LaMiriam. We're supposed to remember what Hashem did to Miriam with the Tzaraas when she spoke about Moshe. So we're supposed to remember that in order to keep ourselves from speaking Lashon Hara, not to speak evil speech. There are certain things we're supposed to remember all the time. One of the things we're supposed to remember daily is leaving Egypt, that Hashem took us out of Egypt. I don't remember the amount of times it says it, but leaving Egypt is mentioned in the Torah dozens and dozens and dozens of times. It is perhaps the one fact that is mentioned most often in the Torah, that Hashem took us out of Egypt. Of course, the most significant one being the Ten Commandments. I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt. Not I am Hashem your God who created the world. We could have said that. I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt. That is the thing that is mentioned the most in the Torah. So we are told to remember it every day. And that is a mitzvah. One should remember the Exodus every day. We say it in the Haggadah that we're supposed to remember it not only in the day, but also at night. We're supposed to remember the going out of Egypt. And this is why in the Shema that is said morning and evening, the third paragraph of Shema, which is about Tzitzis, also has in it the Exodus from Egypt, in order to remember day and night. Moshe says to them, Hayom atem yotzim, you are going out today, b'chodesh ha'aviv, in the month of Aviv. What is Aviv?
Spring.
Spring. So, why does Moshe say that to them? That would be like my telling you, it is June 24th, that's what it is, like June 24th, it is the summer. I think we are all well aware that it is the summer.
Maybe because Hashem is doing a favor by taking them out in nice weather.
Okay, so Moshe is making sure they understand that Hashem could have taken them out any time of the year, but He took us out in the springtime, which is the nicest time to travel. The ground is no longer soggy from the winter time, but it's not too hot either. And it's a nice time to travel. And things are blossoming and blooming everywhere, and it's a nice time to go out. And that's when He took us out of Egypt. And of course, the goal was to go straight from Egypt to Har Sinai, receive the Torah, and then go from there to Israel and go into Israel. That was what was supposed to happen. Had we not sinned with the golden calf and with the spies, it would have been one short process going from Egypt to Har Sinai to Israel. V'ayakiyev Yachar Hashem, and it will be when Hashem will bring you El Eretz HaKenani V'Hachiti V'Hemori V'Hachivi V'Yevusi, to the land of all of these nations. Asher Nishbav Avosech Allah Seslach, that He swore to your ancestors to give to you. Eretz Zavas Chalav Udvash, a land that flows with milk and honey. Who remembers what that means, that it flows with milk and honey? What does it mean, it flows with milk?
Sheep's milk.
Right? So goat's milk. Goat's milk. That was what they normally drank, as we pointed out. Not cow's milk. Goat's milk. And what does it mean? It flows with honey. What kind of honey is that?
Date honey.
Date honey. The Gemara says that they would put dates into a barrel and they would come back a few days later and there would be honey at the top of the barrel. You wouldn't see the dates. The dates would be sunk in a pool of honey. V'avadata et ha'avodah hazos. You shall serve this service. You shall perform this service. B'chodesh hazeh, in this month. Now, what service is he talking about? The Pesach. The sacrifice, the holiday of Pesach. It should be performed in this month. Now, this is one of the places where we learn that we need to synchronize the calendar. With the leap year. We've talked about this a little bit before, but let's reiterate it here. We know that There are primarily two ways of running a calendar. You can run a solar calendar, and you can run a lunar calendar. Most of the world runs with a solar calendar. You have the various seasons, and the months of the year, January, February, etc., don't follow the moon. There are 12 of them, and the entire year is 365 days, with a leap year every so often, in order to keep it straight. And that is the calendar that is used. That is a solar calendar. It follows the solar year, because it takes 365 days and a quarter in order for the Earth to revolve around the sun. one can also follow a lunar calendar, which means you follow the months of the year. And there are 12 months of the year. If you follow that, you're only going to end up with 354 days, which is 11 days less than the solar calendar. And that means that every year you're going to be missing 11 days. You're going to be constantly moving back in the calendar. So in other words, let's say the Muslim calendar follows only a lunar calendar. And that's why their holidays are constantly getting earlier in the year. And if you go over a period of several years, their holidays will actually go around the entire calendar. A holiday that used to be in the fall will, a year or two later, be in the summer. And then a little after that, it'll end up being in the spring, and then it'll be in the winter, and then back in the fall again. It'll move around the calendar because they're losing days comparatively to the solar seasons, because the seasons follow the sun, while, of course, the lunar calendar follows the moon. We do both. We respect the lunar calendar and also the solar calendar. Our holidays follow the lunar months. So the 15th of Nisan, which is a lunar month, is Pesach. And the first day of Tishrei is Rosh Hashanah. So that's completely based on the lunar calendar. But at the same time, we know that we have to respect the solar calendar, the seasons, because the Torah says that you shall serve this service on this month, which means that Pesach has to be in the Chodesh Ha'aviv, in the month of the Aviv, of the springtime. And therefore, we can't allow Nisan, which is the month of Pesach, to end up in the winter, which is what would happen if we wouldn't add a leap month. So we have to add leap months. It is an exceedingly complicated process to know how to set up the lunar calendar so that it will still remain in tandem with the solar calendar. And it is one of the things that points to incredible scholarship amongst our people going way, way, way back, that they were able to know how to do that. It is an incredibly complex mathematical formula to make it work. I can show it to you, but of course I have the benefit of the calendar there in front of me, and I can show you working backwards how they did it. But to have been able to come up with it in the first place is rather complicated. Of course, it was even more complicated in the time of the temple when it was all done through witnesses. Witnesses would see the new moon and come to Beis Din, to the court, and say, "We saw the new moon," and then they would proclaim the new month. And therefore, each month was... it wasn't exactly clear when the first of the month would be. You wouldn't know in advance. And whether they would add a leap month or not depended on many factors, and it was not all set up at the outset. As we Jews began to become more and more dispersed with the destruction of the Second Temple, then Hillel HaKatan, that's a descendant of the great Hillel that we're all familiar with, one of his great-great-great-grandchildren, Hillel, set up the thousand-year calendar that we use today. So that thousand-year calendar is printed. It is in the Tor Shulchan Aruch. It is in any good Jewish study hall will have this thousand-year calendar. It's printed on a spread of a couple of pages. And as I said, I'm happy to bring it in. I can show you how to read it. It's and looking at it from our perspective, we can put it together. But what it took to put it together from scratch is an amazing feat. So here is one of the places where we derive it, because it says that Pesach Nitzri B'Chodesh Ha'aviv, and it says B'Chodesh Hazeh, in this month, which means at the time of the blossoming, the flowering of the plants. Yes.
I have a question. Why does it start off talking about the Bechor and then goes back to Pesach?
Good. Okay. Good. I was hoping someone would ask that question.
Because I know things in the Torah are always in chronological order, but it starts with the Bechor, sanctify the Bechor.
There you go.
Back to Yetzias Mitzrayim and Chametz and all this good stuff.
Okay.
What is the significance of the interruption? What is the trying to say?
Okay. So we've jumped. It's almost a non sequitur. We started with Bechor about redeeming the firstborn, and there's no details.
Right.
We're told, Hashem says, they're mine. What does that mean, they're mine? What do you do with it?
So maybe never mind. Does that mean Hashem, you know, a hand comes out of heaven and plucks them out of your hand? What does that mean? They're mine. They're mine. Okay, thank you. And then it moves on to the laws of Pesach. We've just jumped to something else. And in fact, as you'll see in a moment, before we finish the paragraph, we're going to jump to a third topic. And then we're going to come back to the firstborn. And that will be next week, because we're going to run out of time tonight before we get back to it. So there's been a jump over here. And when I said to Doreen, we're going to cover the male-female thing, it's true we will, but then we start moving into Pesach all of a sudden. So what happened? Because we're going to come back to it. The details of this law of the firstborn and how they get redeemed and how much it costs and all that, the Torah picks up the storyline again a little bit later, right in the next paragraph. So that's a good question. Why did the Torah make this jump? So clearly, the Torah is trying to say this is not a non sequitur. It's not just a connection. They are one and the same. The laws of the firstborn and the laws of Pesach go together. They are one set of laws. There's one set of laws that the Hashem gave us that has to do with the Exodus. And they are all of the Pesach laws, which those we're very familiar with. We're not familiar with the sacrifice laws because that we haven't done in many, many years. But the laws of cleaning the house and eating the matzah and the marah and all that we know about. That we do every year, so we're familiar with it. But the laws of the firstborn, that whole business that I keep saying is so insignificant, that my brother's position isn't really that important, the Torah is saying, no, you have to understand something. That whole area of discussion is part and parcel of the Pesach discussion. That every year Pesach time, if I'm thinking in tune with the Torah, I should be thinking about my brother being a firstborn. It's really important. It's not insignificant. Just as we all know, Pesach is not insignificant. I mean, that we can't possibly forget about Pesach. That is set up in a way where no Jew who has any degree of connection to the Torah can ever forget about Pesach. You can forget about some other things, but you can't forget about Pesach. It hits you, you know, right squarely, right in front of you. So the Bechor, the firstborn as well, the Torah is trying to tell us, is also a significant aspect of the Pesach story. And there's another set of laws, which I want to get to the end of the paragraph just so we see it, and then next time we'll discuss it more in depth so we can see the full picture of the Pesach laws. Pasuk Vav, verse 6, Shivas Yamim Tochal Matzo, 7 days you shall eat matzah. Uvayom Hashvi'i Chag LaHashem, on the 7th day is a holiday to Hashem. As we know, there's the first day of Pesach and the last day of Pesach. Of course, outside of Israel, it's the first days of Pesach and the last days of Pesach are the holiday parts of it. And 7 days of eating matzah. This is not an obligation to eat matzah for 7 days. The only obligation is the first night. But one cannot eat chametz all 7 days. And if one wants to eat a bread substance, one has to have matzah all 7 days. Matzos ye achil eis shivat tamim. Matzos shall be eaten the 7 days. V'lo yeirah elecha chametz. It shall not be seen for you chametz. V'lo yeirah elecha se'or. And shall not be seen for you yeast or leaven. B'chol gvulech on all your boundaries. Again, this does not mean you're not allowed to look at chametz. It means you're not allowed to own chametz. It shouldn't be seen in your possession during the 7 days. V'higarta levincha bayom ahu leimar, you shall tell your son on that day, or your child actually, on that day, saying, this is not only boys, this is boys and girls, you shall tell your children on that day, saying, ba'avor zeh, because of this, meaning because of the matzah and the marah and all the laws that we're keeping, asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mimitzrayim, Hashem did for me when he took me out of Egypt. We discussed this when we talked about the 4 sons. Here we have the verse that tells us that there are children who don't even know how to ask the questions. And for them, we need to introduce the topic to them if they're not ready to ask any questions. We tell them about the story of leaving Egypt. And then the Torah adds another set of laws. V'haya lecha le'os al yadcha, it shall be for you as a sign on your hand. U'lezikaron bein einecha, and as a remembrance between your eyes. Lamantia Torah Hashem b'ficha, so that the Torah of Hashem shall be in your mouth. And what are we talking about here? The tefillin. The tefillin is worn on the arm and on the head, on the forehead, between the eyes. the Torah expresses it as on the hand and between the eyes. One might have thought to place the tefillin on one's palm and actually between the eyes. So how do we know that it doesn't go on the palm, it goes on the arm, on the upper arm, and not between the eyes, but up above the hairline if one has a hairline? Mm-hmm. How do we know that that's where it goes? That's derived from other places in the Torah. But here, the concept of the tefillin is introduced that it should be worn on the arm and on the head. And the purpose of the tefillin is so that the Torah of Hashem shall be in your mouth, which means you shall speak about the Torah. As Rashi says, people will see the tefillin and say, what is that all about? And they'll talk about the Torah. What part of the Torah will they talk about?
It's
going out of Egypt. Wearing tefillin is supposed to be something that gets people to talk about leaving Egypt. So that also, that's something which most of us don't think about in that way, that it is something that is meant to be part of the Exodus story. For with a strong hand, Hashem took you out of Egypt. You shall guard or keep this statute in its time, miyamim yamima, from years to years. Days to days, which means years to years. Year to year. Every year you shall keep it. So we have our work cut out for us for next week, which is going to be to further understand the connections between the entire Pesach set of laws and the firstborn and the tefillin. And as I said, there's one more paragraph here that's going to also deal with these three themes. And then there are going to be a lot of details which we have to cover. We have more to cover about firstborn. We will deal with, please God, we will deal with Doreen's question. And also, we need to cover a lot of details about tefillin. And there you have a question as well. Why do men wear tefillin and not women? That's also a question that needs to be dealt with. We can't leave that hanging. That has to be dealt with as well. So there's a lot to talk about next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.